thought it was 2 o'clock.
No problem.
Sorry.
We all got a chance to meet each other.
Yeah.
Would you like to use the
Good afternoon. I must start by apologizing profusely. Somehow I had this written down for 2 o'clock. So I truly apologize. My name is Deborah Spahr, and if you all will forgive me for showing up this late, thank you for coming. This is the panel. Obviously, you've had lots of time to look over the materials on entrepreneurship in developing markets and the role of internet and other communications technologies in these markets. We are very fortunate to have some wonderful panelists here today. Let me very, very briefly introduce them to you, and so we can just proceed directly with the panel. We'll begin first with Mr. Craig Smith, who has a long and distinguished history in this field. He's currently the president of Digital Partners, which is a Seattle-based nonprofit research group, and he works there exploring the link between digital technology and social issues, something which all the panelists do to some extent or another. He's also had a distinguished career in the field of philanthropy, working at the Indiana University Center in Philanthropy, at the Conference Board, and various other research institutions. He's an author. I'm not going to read you all of his publications, but one of the things that caught my eye, most importantly, is a major report for the Ford Foundation called The Digital War on Poverty. So we look forward to his remarks. I'm just going to introduce all the panelists and then leave you free to speak. Next is Mr. Rupert Schofield, who is currently FINCA's International Executive Director. He's an agricultural economist who has worked for over 30 years in the developing countries of Latin America. He has also been the CEO of Rural Development Services, a consulting company, and a program director for the AFL-CIO's labor program in El Salvador. Next is Dr. Eduardo Da Costa, who is founder and chairman of the board of a consulting and executive training company called Nest Boston. He also is very active in a public incubator company in Brazil and has currently completed a very interesting manuscript that I will confess I actually reviewed for MIT Press. Which is going to be published for MIT Press, so I know it's exciting.
It's your fault.
It's my fault, no. On global e-commerce strategies for small businesses. And last, we have actually an old friend and classmate of mine, Monique Maddy. We went to school at Georgetown University together many years ago, where we both received degrees at the School of Foreign Service. Monique has since gone on to a very distinguished and fascinating career. She worked for a while with the UNDP. Then we met up again at Harvard Business School, where she received her MBA. Then she founded one of the most interesting companies I've seen in the past decade called Edesimi Communications, a telecommunications company in Africa. She was one of the few people, maybe perhaps one of the only people, to build a telecommunications company in Africa. And she is currently now doing one of the boldest things one can do, and she's writing a novel. So I will start again. I apologize profusely. I promise I won't talk at all because I already stole so much of your time. And I will turn the floor over to Mr. Smith.
Good afternoon. I'm going to say a few things, maybe to set a bit of a framework for the panel on social entrepreneurship. My basic point is that I'm sure many of you are aware of theories of the industrial paradigm and how everything's changing now in the era of networked communications. But in the industrial paradigm, the way social issues were addressed had very little to do with entrepreneurship. In fact, entrepreneurs were kind of relegated to a kind of weirdo status. The risks of entry were so high, and the cost of entry was so low, so great, and the penalty for failure as an entrepreneur was so great that only people with rather extreme personalities would become entrepreneurs, who were sort of not people who tended to be part of the civic culture. So if you look at the realm of business, government, nonprofits, and the world of philanthropy, entrepreneurship didn't have a major role in the setting of the agenda. It was quite peripheral. You know, some industries like Hollywood and so forth were imbued with entrepreneurship, but basically it was external to the way we did things in the industrial world. Now, as we get into the logic of networked economy, suddenly the business world is embracing a framework in which all 6 billion of the total population may be become entrepreneurs. You have companies such as Charles Schwab, which is defining its global brand identity, redefining its global brand identity around closing the digital divide by democratizing finance and connecting billions and billions of people to markets and to entrepreneurial activity. So in the what's happened, I think, with entrepreneurship fits three different dimensions. The first dimension is how social entrepreneurship is entering into the business realm. The second dimension is how entrepreneurship is entering into the realm of social problem solving or the realm of philanthropy. And the third dimension is a synthesis between both of those approaches, which is, I believe, will emerge around the concept of diaspora philanthropy, or what it will mean for entrepreneurs who have achieved success in the developed world, who are from developing countries, to go back to their home countries and build out the networked economy at home, having gathered skills and fortune as entrepreneurs in the advanced countries. So the three points I'm making is, first, social entrepreneurship is arising as a central feature of the business world. Second point, again, is entrepreneurship principles integrated into philanthropy. And the third is this new approach that synthesizes the two. Okay, first of all, the commercial models. I think the best example I know to demonstrate this point is the point that increasingly businesses have to incorporate social factors into their business models linked to entrepreneurship. Jeffrey Kirkman, who helped organize, or was the lead spark plug in organizing this conference, told me he was leaving to San Salvador, and I said, "What are you doing?" "Well, I'm going to another conference on e-commerce or e-development." And I said, "Well, what is it, Inter-American Development Bank?" And he said, "No, Microsoft." Increasingly, every major internet company is putting a public interest spin on its international business strategies. You know, after Teledesic in seeing the demise of Motorola's, Iridium, noted that Iridium didn't really put a public interest spin on its networks of satellites. Teledesic, on the other hand, in trying to build support for its network of low orbiting satellites, is completely recasting its strategies around how that network of satellites will make possible an explosion of entrepreneurship in the developing world. So every major company now is developing the intellectual capital in order to talk about itself as a champion of entrepreneurship, breakthroughs in entrepreneurship in the developing world. So companies are having to develop that intellectual capital really for the first time in history. Okay, the second point, how entrepreneurship is entering the world of philanthropy. The major dot-com foundations, the Gates Foundation, the Glaser Foundation, the McCaw Foundation, the Paul Allen Foundation, the major multi-billion dollar foundations that are being created as a byproduct of the information revolution, if you look closely to see their strategies for their program strategies for social change, they're imbued with entrepreneurship principles in ways that the Ford Foundation and Rockefeller and Carnegie never really embraced and are having a difficult time, frankly, embracing now. if you look to see the way the Gates Foundation has sought to serve the healthcare needs of poor children in Africa and other developing areas, it's sought to correct market failure in pharmaceuticals by guaranteeing demand for vaccines for malaria and other diseases. This kind of strategy flows from the ability of entrepreneurs to look at a social issue and come out with a kind of a way of reframing a social issue based on entrepreneurship principles. At a lower level than the moguls of the digital revolution, the multi-billionaires, we have networks like Social Venture Partners, which is also created in Seattle but is now proliferated as a network throughout the United States, which is basically collections of IT entrepreneurs that are trying to apply venture capital principles to the stabilizing support for nonprofit organizations. So venture philanthropy is in fact the dominant trend now in the world of philanthropy, and it's clearly will increase as we get deeper and deeper into network communications. But this only brings us so far, because philanthropy as a field is still quite stuck on the notion that the aim of philanthropy is to build up, to stabilize the nonprofits that they've been working with in the past. I think the next step is to look beyond the current interests of nonprofits and to look freshly at the new possibilities for philanthropy to trigger change in the world generally, and how venture capital principles and entrepreneurship principles can really trigger change in government and business and nonprofits and academia and so forth. And this brings us to my third point, which is about diaspora philanthropy. To an extent that very few people realize, Silicon Valley and the other high-tech regions were really built by the intellectual capital from the developing world, from Taiwan, from Singapore, from China, from India, from Israel, and from Russia. There's a tremendous amount of expertise from those countries, the brain drain, if you will, that has built the critical mass of thinking about how you develop markets in the internet era. Increasingly, these clusters of entrepreneurs from the developing world will be going back to build out internet markets in their home countries. And as they do so, they'll be developing business models that will be fully marinated in public interest considerations, so that when the Indians go back to India, they'll be able to position themselves as champions of social reform in India through their business activity. At the same time, they'll be developing philanthropy concepts that will complement those business models, that will make possible new ways of linking venture capital with philanthropy, social venture capital, if you will, new mechanisms that bring those two worlds together in a more intimate interconnection than we now have. India clearly is in the leading edge of this, but China is following it. We at Digital Partners are working at helping establish a collective conversation between groups of entrepreneurs from developing countries about how they could trigger change, particularly in behalf of poverty reduction in their home countries, India again being the leading edge of that conversation. So we think that the staging area for closing the digital divide, the closing area for bringing social issues and entrepreneurship into full integration, will be in the engagement of these diaspora as they meet the forces of reform within their home countries, leading through the fulfillment potentially of this vision to build a bottoms-up market for creating 6 billion entrepreneurs. It's a kind of utopian vision, but it is in fact the driving force, much more than fortune, that is in fact propelling the development of this whole the spread of the internet economy. I guess that's it. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for laying out such big themes so neatly and clearly. We'll move directly to Mr. Schofield.
Great. Well, listening to Craig, you know, about how the entrepreneurs used to be such a, you know, unusual, extreme bunch, and looking around at this panel, I wonder how much has really changed. I certainly couldn't. I'd have to dispute that from my experience. I'm sort of the digitally challenged member of this panel, and I have to confess that I've come to technology slowly. I always wondered why the youthful people in my foundation were always after me to get into technology. But I've had a very interesting week, and I'd have to say a transformational week, which for me began with the Digital Dividends Conference out in Seattle. And I have to say, you know, even though I went in there thinking I had something of a grasp of the issue because I knew what a gigabyte was, and then when I was there I heard something called a terabyte and a petabyte, which sound like early Jurassic lizards, but I assume they just mean it's got a hell of a lot of zeros on it. But I'm a believer now, so you can at least take credit for having made one convert. From what I heard in Seattle and what I've seen and heard here and the people I've met here, we're in a new world. I may be the last one to realize that in this room, but I'm utterly convinced of it now. And I'd like to tell you a bit. I'd like to thank Jeffrey and everyone else who organized this conference, and particularly Jeffrey for giving me so little guidance on what to say today. I sent him a number of emails saying, "What do you want me to talk about?" And he said, "Well, you'll know, you know." And he was right. So. Yeah. In any case, let me tell you something quickly about Finca, and I'm going to make an assumption, which I hope is not wrong, that most of you know something about microcredit or microfinance, and I hope that assumption's right because it'll have a lot to do with the content choice I made for this presentation. But basically, Finca's mission is to provide financial services to the world's poorest families, or as it was put out in Seattle, the B3B, the bottom 3 billion. Now, if you're not familiar with these people, these are the people who are not clients of the private banking departments of Chase Manhattan and the Bank of Boston and Travelers Cities. They're the poorest people on earth. When they come into our program, they're typically earning $1 or $2 a day. Hopefully, after they've received our three services, which are credit, savings, and a group experience for social and personal empowerment, they get up to the spectacular levels of maybe $5 or $10 a day. But of course, this is a major transformation in a developing country where an extra dollar a day can mean the difference literally between life and death. Finca grew out of an entrepreneurial vision. My partners and I had been in the Peace Corps in the 60s and the 70s in Latin America. We were having a good time and making a good living working for clients like the World Bank and the UN and AID. And I guess we did some useful projects there, but we felt that we were getting farther and farther away from the people that we wanted to help, which were the really poor, the people that I had lived with in my little town in the highlands of Guatemala. And we wanted to try something, so we started to take some of our resources, some of the profits of our firm, and put it directly into microloans. And we found initially that the repayment rate and the response of these people, what they did with the money was so incredibly inventive and creative that we needed to raise more money for this operation. And so we basically spent the next 5 years building an infrastructure and a delivery system for this. To fast forward to the present, our operation, which started out of my converted garage back in 1985, today we have a network of 20 programs in as many countries. We're serving 165,000 entrepreneurs, 90% of whom, by the way, are women. And we lent $65 million last year and recovered all but about 50,000 of it. The impact of these programs are immediate and often dramatic. You see the people able to feed their children better, give them give money to the kids to pay their school fees, improve their houses, and so forth. But let's talk a bit about what e-development, or what this new economy and this new technology has meant to Finca. And I was exaggerating a bit. I'm not exactly as naive as I let on. We have been using email, we have been using cell phones, we've been using a lot of the latest technology, and really it's made it possible for us to create a network where we have common standards and common products and training programs and so forth. And it's also made it possible for us to build an infrastructure which, if we can raise sufficient capital and if we can attract sufficient human resources, and I hope that's where maybe some of the people in this room, particularly the young people, may come in, we think we can really massify this product and get millions of people out of poverty. Not Finca alone, of course, but the many other organizations that are working in microcredit. So how directly does technology help Finca and help the clients? Well, for the clients, it lowers the transaction costs. It allows us to make a $50 loan or a $100 loan to a poor woman in Ecuador or in Azerbaijan at a reasonable interest rate. Normally, a commercial bank wouldn't be able to make a loan of $10,000 without a considerable transaction cost, a couple hundred dollars. Then they wouldn't even think about making a $50 or $100 loan because it would cost them five times that amount to process it. We're also able to tap the marketing potential of our clients. Our clients often produce good products of a high quality, but they just don't know where to sell them locally, let alone internationally. And we're starting to collaborate with some organizations to see if we can hook up our clients via the internet with markets. Another thing that I heard actually today, and I'm going to take away with me another use of the internet, is this e-shame that the Indian gentleman talked about as a means of fighting corruption. Now, I know my 165,000 clients will be very happy to hear that's a development, because my people, particularly in the former Soviet Union, have to go out into the markets every day, and usually the first customer they have is a tax collector with his hand out. And after that, it'll be a food inspector. And now, not to knock on these people, they're trying to make a living too. They're probably paid $15 a month or $20 a month. And so they basically are told to go out and supplement their income at the expense of the people trying to do business in those countries. And so it's a very interesting development to me that we may see some progress on that point. And I also want to give you some examples, since we are in this venue of a law school, for how I think entrepreneurialism, market reform, legal reform, and e-development all kind of come together. And I'd like to tell you a story of, from Kyrgyzstan, where I recently had a meeting with the president. We have a wonderful program there. We have about 18,000 clients to whom we've lent $20 million over the past 5 years in bits of $100 or so. And we've only lost 7,000 in that whole process. And this whole bank, if you will, has grown an infrastructure within the country of little groups of 10 to 15 women who are borrowing and saving. You could think of them as nodes. And they collectively are now the largest operating financial institution in Kyrgyzstan. Now, part of the reason they are is because the other commercial banks have stopped lending because the justice system doesn't function. And when a loan goes bad, as it usually does, there's no way for the commercial bank to collect. So I was talking to the president about this and other problems. And I said, you know, we've been working in your country for 5 years now, but we've been under the auspices or the protection of the bilateral agreement between your government and my government, and that's coming to an end. So we don't want to continue as a refugee in your country, as it will, with no legal status. So we need to do something. We need to move in to a new legal form. And he said a very interesting thing, I thought. He said, you know, Schofield, I was a physicist and a mathematician in my earlier life under the communist regime. And I learned that when you discovered a physical reaction, you shouldn't mess with it. You should just watch it and observe it for another, for a couple of years, allow it to develop before you tried to harness it or manipulate it or control it. And I thought that was a very encouraging thing for this man who's leading the country and I hope will be reelected in a few short days to say. Because to me, the significance of that is that, in, to put it in other, in simple terms, we can work with a person like this. The e-community can work with him, the private sector can work with him. And so I proposed to him, I said, let's make an example, let's make a model of private sector government cooperation in Kyrgyzstan, in this little republic nobody, you know, hardly anybody knows about. Let's have FINCA and your government work together to create enabling legislation which allows us to realize our full potential and allows us to bring these fledgling entrepreneurs, these 20,000 people, to their full potential. So I have great hopes. We'll see what happens out of that. I'd just like to close by sharing with you another kind of revelation to me, and it has to do with what Craig has been talking about. And I think this, for me, was the unexpected discovery in Seattle. It was no less a person than Bill Gates, who was sort of the climax of the meeting. He was the last presenter. And I have to say, some of us were a little dismayed, because after we'd spent the whole week, you know, hearing these eloquent cases for how people were working with the bottom 3 billion of the world, doing business with them profitably to mutual benefit. Our moderator, a fellow from Business Week, said to Bill Gates, "So, Bill, what are your plans to do business with the bottom 3 billion people earning $1 a day? And there was a silence, and Gates looked at him, and I don't remember exactly what he said, but it was something like, "You're kidding, aren't you?" And he said, "Well, no, we've just heard, Bill, you know, about these creative schemes and how, you know, you don't have to just give stuff away to poor people. You don't have to give them money or medicine or whatever. You know, you can help them earn an income, and then they can, you know, they can purchase all these services." And Gates said, you said a dollar a day, right? He said, those people don't have electricity. They don't have light, you know? I mean, you couldn't plug a computer into them, you know? And our journalist moderator was obviously discomfited. And so he said, well, how about $3 a day? And Gates, without missing a beat, said, now you're talking. But I guess the breakthrough for me, and I've heard it here also, I've heard people who normally would not, and maybe they'd watch these people on TV in some kind of social disturbance, but they would never go out and work with them and do business with them and meet them. But now that people are, I'm hearing another side to this whole equation. We're discovering what these people have to offer for us. We're hearing about their spirituality. People are saying, you know, these are incredibly generous people. I went out to their house and they killed their last chicken for me and they fed me and they told me that I was a gift from God. And I got a feeling that I guarantee you I never got from any of my paying clients, and I got a real payoff. And I think this is a part of the whole equation. In any case, thanks.
Thank you very much. And Dr. DaCosta.
Thank you, Deborah, and thank you, Jeffrey, for inviting me for this session. I think I have the privilege of having 3 points, as you had two, so I'll try to do my 3 points here. The first one is I'm also a true believer in the opportunities that are open by the internet and electronic commerce in particular. So I'm not only a convert, but I've been a true believer in this church for a long time. And if it were a religion, I think I would go to Mass every Sunday. Now, one thing that has been discussed here during this event is if governments should or should not do something about it. And I think this discussion only has a meaning in this country or perhaps in some other very developed countries. In the developing countries, the only way that the digital, not the digital, but the social divide can be helped, and I prefer to refer to the digital bridge, not the digital divide. We have a social divide, and the digital bridge could help and solve the problem. Help, not solve the problem. But governments have to do something about it. It's a question of government intervention. In the developing countries, the role that the governments play in the economic world is so much greater than it is here that it's just impossible to think that any significant change would happen without governments actually intervening. And there are very, apart from the traditional things that governments have to do, like regulation and legislation and proposed legislation, there's also very practical things that they can do that could change the situation completely. For instance, if governments start to buy electronically, and the government is a major player in the economies of the developing countries, if they decide to buy electronically and open the opportunities to small companies, this alone could make a complete change in the scenario, because then suddenly all the small companies would be going directly to the electronic world just to compete for the bids in the government. So my first message to you, and I want to be very brief, is that I'm a true believer in this digital bridge. It's a possibility, and governments can and should indeed intervene to make it happen. The second point is how governments do this, and I want now to refer directly to small businesses and entrepreneurs. And governments in general, they make a mess when they try to help small companies. And this is not because governments are intrinsically bad or multilateral organizations are always doing wrong things. It's just that it is very, very difficult to deal with small companies because they are so diverse. In fact, small companies are one of the beauties of an economy that is run by small companies is that diversification, which is a very nice characteristic of society, is increased. Some of you might remember a book that was very popular in the 70s. It was a bestseller called Small is Beautiful. Now, Fritz Schumacher, who wrote the book, he used to start his lectures drawing a line on a blackboard saying, this is unity and this is uniformity. And he refers to this unity at the top as this is God, uniformity is hell. And then he went along talking about diversification and how small things would make the world better. So governments don't do a good job because it is very difficult to do so. In fact, many governments, strange enough, refer to small companies as their priority. You probably heard this in many countries. This is the priority now. Small business will be contemplated with all kinds of help from the government. And I remember this during a play that some of you might have seen or watched on film or on stage called The Fiddler on the Roof. In The Fiddler on the Roof, it's a play about a Jewish village in the Russian Empire, 19th century. And the Cossacks, the Russian Cossacks, went into the village and rampaged the village and everything. So it was fire everywhere, and it was a mess. And then in the middle of the thing, this main character called Tevi, he raises his hands to the sky and says, God, we have been the chosen people for 2,000 years. Could you just choose someone else? So I think entrepreneurs and small business in many countries think more or less the same. So if we have people from government here that have declared small businesses their priority, or multilateral organizations as well, I think there's a very simple recipe for how to go about helping small companies, and that is ask them. It's just amazing how many programs have been set up that have very little to do with what small companies really need or hope or want for some in some specific region. So my second message is very simple. If you want to help small companies in any particular area, region, or country, just ask them what they need, and you will be surprised that it's probably different from what you thought of at the beginning. Now, my private experience recently has been with an incubator company in Brazil. And this incubator, in fact, it's a concept that has been around for two or three decades. Many universities and agencies, government agencies, have started incubators in many countries, trying to help small companies to grow. Now, the degree of success of most incubators has been very small in the past few decades. And this is mostly because people in the incubators that we have today, they mostly were concerned with the actual space and electricity and some kind of subsidized rent for the space. And that has very little to do, again, if you ask them, with what small companies really need. So what we are doing there in Brazil, and many companies are doing here in the US as well, is to have private incubators where the incubator is a private company and is directly related to the success of the incubated companies. So what we have in our case in Brazil is that small companies don't need really space or computers. They all have computers already, these people who we are talking to. And what they need is information about something that is much more difficult for young entrepreneurs, and that is, for instance, market analysis. identification of opportunities, how to set up operations. It's very common for someone to say, well, we'll have this business that will be, have 1 million customers in 6 months. And then you say, well, what will be your customs relations procedures for this company? Nobody knows anything about this. And so to help small companies in this context, we have done this consulting company in Brazil that now is a private incubator that tried to help small companies with what they actually need, which is experts on things that are not obvious at the beginning, like operations, marketing, and legal procedures, network, financial help, and everything. And most of these companies, in our case, there are other incubators in Brazil. In our case, we are dealing with ideas that have a chance in the international market. So we are not taking any idea that is a me-too thing, just bringing whatever is happening here or somewhere else into Brazil. We want ideas in Brazil that can be used anywhere. And you will be surprised of how many good ideas there are all over the world about the internet. And many of them seem obvious once you just hear them. It's just something that it's so new. In fact, the internet has been around. I used to call people in lectures saying, well, how long do you think the internet has been around? And then someone says, it's 30 years, 40 years, 10 years or something. Commercially, the internet has been around for 6 years. In the developing world, it's even less. So it's three, four years, depending on the country. So it's a very new thing. And ideas about this new technique and application are popping up everywhere. And one of the ideas, just to give you a suggestion about what the kind of thing that pops up, one idea that we didn't take in Brazil, and I'll tell you why we didn't follow this one, but just to show what kind of thing that pops up, is the idea of have your telephone number as your email address. So that seems very stupid. You say, well, many people do this. No, it's not operating yet, this idea of having your telephone number as your email address. And the funny thing is that many people remember your phone number, or they have a note of your phone number, but they don't have your email address. And it changes very quickly, because once you change your ISP, you have a different email address. And sometimes you start losing your contacts all over the world. So if you had that as your number, so it would be your telephone number, at, and then the name of the actual business. This would be a very interesting idea, and you could develop all kinds of services related to this. And, well, some of you can pursue this idea, there's no copyright on this, but we didn't take this idea in Brazil. It's because it is so simple that we just checked with our lawyers, the ones who are with third party lawyers in Brazil. We asked, can we have a patent for the idea? And they said, no, this is too simple. You cannot patent this thing. So we didn't take it, because it's so simple that any of the large companies in Brazil could just take it and transform that into a service. So it's just to tell you of the kinds of things that happen everywhere that could be transformed into businesses. And it could happen, it has, and it is happening in Brazil, and it can happen in any place in the world. It's just a question of trying to find these people and give the right support for them, and you will be really spreading the word and spreading development all over the world. Thank you.
Thank you very much for raising more questions and possibly answers as well. And we will conclude with Monique Maddy.
Yeah, well, I've been sitting here, and it sort of brings me to a parallel about a year ago, actually exactly 1 year ago. I was invited to a conference that was sponsored by the Wall Street Journal that was called the Millennium Conference. And it was actually the Wall Street Journal, Harvard Business School, and Microsoft. There was about 100 people really the largest corporations, as I said, the Wall Street Journal, Microsoft, Goldman Sachs, Chase, all of them and marketing companies, and all of them were actually represented by their CEOs. And so the day, it was a whole day's discussion, and we were talking about how e-commerce would affect the world in general. And the keynote speaker was actually the president of Microsoft, Steve Ballmer. And as the day went on, we talked about all the revolutionary changes that would be coming to, you know, to all the world as a result of the advances in communications, especially the internet. And some of the examples were how we'd be able to smell pizza from our computers and, you know, do all of these fancy things, control our, we could watch TVs with our colleagues who, and discuss them while they were in different cities. And at some point I asked, you know, well, you know, what's this going to do for the rest of the world? The, you know, these 4 billion, actually more like 4 billion people. And one of the panelists, who is actually a very prominent technology analyst, said, well, you know, we just give them internet and access to computers and so forth. And so as I'm sitting here, at that time I felt, you know, that, well, these people just didn't get it. And so I'm sitting here today and I see, you know, we're all talking about how we're going to bring, use e-commerce to solve the problems of the developing world. Where, and again, you're saying you're talking about a bridge as opposed to a digital divide. The statistics are that there are about 350 million, at least this was the statistic a year ago, 350 million computer users, of which about two-thirds are in the United States and the rest are evenly distributed between Western Europe and some parts of Asia. So that is what I'd call a digital divide. Between the rest, the US and the rest of the world, I call it a chasm. That, and the, and I see that this is a problem because we have on one side, we have these really large corporations who really don't get it on that end. And then I think on this side where I think some of us might suffer from some of the same simplification in terms of what the internet can do and where we are today with it. And I'm just speaking from my experience as an, you'd called it, something about the brain drain, trying to reverse the brain drain. Anyway, I'm originally from West Africa, and I did go back to try to do this, and I did this. And so I think I'm the only one who can actually speak of the actual implementation of these of the internet and these other technologies. And what I mean, entrepreneurship in the developing world or here isn't that much difference when it comes to, you know, you have to raise capital and, you know, build a team and so forth. Where it starts to differ, and which I believe is the major problem, which none of us so far has talked about, and I think is the critical issue, is the political situations in these countries as well as the regulatory environment. I'm a believer that the money is definitely not a scarcity, and the only issue with the money in this case is that I think we tend to be distracted when we think that, you know, foundations are the ones that are going to be able to bridge this divide. And the truth is that it's not going to be foundations. They'll just, I mean, I consider it really a tip in the ocean, a drop in the ocean, really. And what we need is Microsoft itself attracted to these markets and actually going into these markets, not just to sell computers, but actually manufacture. But I don't see Bill Gates, even for $3 a day, even for, you know, $100, you know, we're talking about people who are making, as you said, $3, $5 a day. I don't see these large corporations that are actually needed to stimulate development going into some of these poorer markets. And I think the primary reason they don't do that is because, and these are the issues that we encountered, were one is the regulatory environments in these markets are extremely complex and they often aren't implemented, the rules that are there, and also the technology, they don't have rules that exist because they're so new, and the management capacity to deal with all of these new technologies they lack. And then just the whole instability. I mean, we had, in our company, we had attracted the the cream of the crop in terms of investors. We had large U.S. venture capitalists who were looking to enter these emerging markets as a way to see how does this succeed. And we weren't looking. We did happen to be in an area. Our service was providing communications through wireless payphones and voicemail to people in the middle and lower income. So it wasn't people who could afford cell phones and so forth. And so it did happen to be a socially good thing, but our main objective was really to make money. And that's what drives all venture capitalists. I'm not quite sure about this whole mixture of social entrepreneurship. I mean, that's something that I found to be quite confusing, because among our investors, we actually had your cold venture capitalists, so to speak, who, you know, show me the money, and we had these sort of the governmental investors that try to do socially good as well, and we found that the venture capitalists at Trent Tradition were much more business savvy, business oriented, and knew what it took to actually make money in these markets. And that is, you take a lot of risk, and also you have to dig deep and lay out a significant amount of capital. Whereas I'd call them do-gooders, we'll just give a little and, you know, let's see what's going to happen. And, you know, and that's not how any country that I know in this world developed, by putting, small loans here and there. And I think this divide is just going to grow wider and wider. And so after 6 years of doing this and seeing that there was going to be no coming together of the what I call the do-wellers as opposed to the do-gooders, we decided to liquidate the company, and some of the operations are still running. But so I just think that the theory is really good to talk about, and I'm not saying I have any solutions for the future, but I think that the internet is unfortunately not the cure-all that we seem to think it is, and I think in many ways we're deluding ourselves when these governments aren't even giving many of them these 3 billion people, they have hardly access to water, to electricity, and I think it's a lot more complex, and I think until you do get the major corporations looking at this as a serious issue or something that needs to be addressed, I think we'll be having, quite a few more conferences, unfortunately.
You're supposed to say fortunately. Unfortunately, we are running out of time, which is once again my fault. Let me ask you if you'd like to raise a question. Take 30 seconds now. Come up to the mic. I will take 3 or 4 questions. I will ask you, please, to make them as short as possible. We will give them simultaneously to the panelists for a closing round of remarks, and then we'll turn it over to Mr. Pentland for the final remarks. Let me, as people are coming up, take small advantage here just to say I found all the comments very interesting, and there's actually quite a bit of disagreement, I think, among the panelists, and it would be interesting to get a bit of a sense of that, to just underscore some of it. I think everyone agrees that there is a problem, whether it's a bridge, a gap, a divide, a chasm, there's a problem. The question is, whose problem is it? Is this a problem for governments? Is it a problem for business as a business issue? Is it a problem for business as a social issue? Is it a problem for us as consumers, which isn't something that actually came up? The other buried question, of course, is, does technology put us into a new paradigm, or are we still left with the same old paradigm we've always had, and we just have new tools with which to think about it? I won't answer those. I will throw them out. And you have the floor, sir.
Yeah, this is more of a comment, but I'm a venture capitalist, and I just wanted to give a couple of comments here. I've been involved.
So just keep it short.
I'll try to keep it really short. I just want to talk about very briefly the fact that we are trying to change the paradigm here. The poverty reduction industry has been one that's been around for about 50 years, and this industry does need shaking up. I got a question very briefly. What does Bill Gates have in common with a guy that's making $2 or $3 a day? Does anybody know? Human being is one. Anything else? They're both self-employed. okay? And it's the jobs, excuse the word, stupid, that we all have to focus on for these folks. We can talk about education, but education should be a catalyst for self-employment. Education should be the R&D that comes up with ideas for self-employment opportunities, that takes the self-employment opportunities and brings them up a level from just cows and little retail stands and gets into technology, because we have this stuff on our shelves. Government should be a catalyst to transparency, because transparency gives us the level playing field that allows us to do business and allow self-employed people to function. And then government should get out of the way. Number three is that we need to have a social street like a Wall Street. I get all the data I want about Wall Street and the opportunities. I don't have a darn thing to look at with Social Street. I don't know what the market opportunities are. And in fact, we need to translate the social opportunities into market opportunities. Number four, businesses and entrepreneurship need to really look at this whole area as a market opportunity. We have over 2 to 3 billion people that represent the largest market opportunity right now in the world. So they need to be educated that this is not a macro opportunity, it is in fact a micro opportunity. And we need to get them educated that they should not, when they come into a developing country, do a deal with the wealthy gatekeeping families and allow those folks to continue to run their businesses, but they must reach out and reach out to those folks who are disenfranchised from the free enterprise system and should be included in. So in summary, you need transparency to allow the way. Number two, you need training and connectivity to pave the way. Number three, you need data and market research to show you the way. And number four, you need quality self-employment opportunities and best practices in order to walk the way. Thank you.
Thanks. Well, I think that sort of exhausts our question time, which is good because I don't have long lines. Since there weren't any direct questions to the panelists, I think in the issue of time, I am going to formally close this session, and I will go beyond my authority here to say please feel free to attack any of the panelists after the session if you have extra questions that you would like to ask them. Thank you, all of you, for raising such interesting and provocative remarks.
I'll tell you what, before...
It's not over, it's just the panel that's over.
When is it over?
Since we had a long sort of gap in the middle, I'd like to just sort of, almost the last person. I'm going to spend about 5 minutes speaking, and I'm going to let the panel sit for another 5 minutes.
Oh, sorry. Yeah.
How's that? Just so that we all get out of here and go forward. My name's Alec Pentland. I'm the academic head of the Media Lab. This conference and the day before, which was Digital Nations, the last 3 days has been a unique partnership between what is probably the world's leading technology laboratory and the leading policy and analysis group in the world at MIT and at Harvard. And I think that it's a partnership we announced as an ongoing research consortium. So at least 5 years, and hopefully more than that, where we're going to be bringing the brightest students from all around the world, from the developing nations, from underserved communities, to work with the best tools and the best minds to invent solutions to this. Because I think the thing that, and pardon all the bright people who work very hard in this audience, I think the one thing that stands out is we don't know what the real solution to all these problems are. And I think the best plan for finding that solution is to bring these young minds from all around the world and expose them to people like the people in this auditorium and have them think about, invent, try out on the ground in real projects the solutions that they've come up with, critique it, and go back and invent again. And my hope is in the next 2, 3, 4, 5 years, from those students and from this joint alliance between Harvard and MIT, which, by the way, is a pretty unique thing just to begin with. The two schools rarely talk. That from that alliance, we're going to have a series of conferences like this where we're going to have an increasing percentage of success stories, an increasing percentage of understanding of the process of how IT and indeed things like biotech can be used to effectively change conditions in the developing world and in underserved communities, in health, in education, and in e-commerce. And I think this is the beginning of something very exciting. I want to thank you all for coming here and participating and educating our students and helping us go in the right direction. And I hope that probably in about a year and a half, we'll come back and be able to show you that we've learned from you and have actually come up with some things that are very interesting. The final thing, I want to thank the people who worked so hard to put the eDevelopment Conference together. Jeffrey, Colin, Meg, and Mike Best, who, happy birthday, Mike. Thank you all.
Okay, I really am the last, and then we'll let you guys get out of here. I know a lot of you came a very long distance and are on your way back. We'd like to thank you for that, especially. On behalf of the Berkman Center, the Media Lab, and CID, again, thank you so much for your attendance and your participation. What was exciting to us when we thought about putting this conference together was bringing the different groups that each of our institutions reaches together to cross-pollinate and fertilize the different efforts that go on. As lawyers at the Berkman Center, we very frequently work on regulatory and legal issues related to development, and we take questions from governments around the world, we talk to people around the world about those issues, but we very rarely have a chance to get in depth with the technology and with the more serious work of development that CID does, and the technology with the Media Lab. So to us, this was a great opportunity to bring these groups together, and I hope that you all have taken this opportunity to meet one another as you came here, perhaps because you already knew one of the institutions, but not all three. So thank you so much. We really appreciate your being here. We hope that you will take advantage of the archive that will be going up and that you will spread the word about the archive to those who are not able to be here, but who might find something helpful in what was said. So thank you. Have a safe trip home.
But at least he can't say it.
Yeah, probably.
Thanks, that was after recognized.